Silence. The hissing lamp. Bursts of sleet on the window. How lined and weary was Charlie's face, Dieter thought. He was old beyond his 35 years. You ask me about the company's cut in New Zealand. Where once a grove of the noble kauri grew, I came upon acres of devastation. The killing ground could only be differentiated from the gum fields by the fresher stumps. Dieter shuddered. The gum fields that he and Lavinia had seen were the most desolate landscapes, churned mud where nothing grew, great holes gouged in the wet earth, swamps without vegetation where moiling creatures clawed for bits of ancient resin to improve paint. Charlie talked, and when he paused, Dieter asked, "What of New England, where my cousin Arminius first cruised the woods for James Duke? I have not been there since I visited Mr. Marsh a year or two after you were born." "Why, northern New England is a world of denuded mountains, scarred by railroad tracks and erosion. Slash, charred logs, millions of stumps, and endless miles of washed-out roads. I don't see how fish can live in New England waters unless they can breathe silt. Large fires every summer, and still the rivers carry log drives, pitifully small sticks for the pulp mills and pressed wood fabricators." Dieter's voice was low. "Was all destruction? Did you see nothing good and beautiful?" "Yes, I did. Brazil has the most profoundly diverse forests on earth." For the first time since his return, there was enthusiasm in Charlie's voice. "The striking feature is the mix of species rather than large groves or aggregates of dominant trees. Foreigners are in constant wonderment. When they return to their countries, they see how barren and meager are their homelands." "I have always championed diversity." "It is in the tropics, not only in Brazil, but in Colombia, Costa Rica, Venezuela, in India and Malaysia. Forests filled with mangoes, guava, passion fruit, star fruit, coconuts, bananas. The tropical forests are the most wondrous forests I ever saw. Spectacular forests, but now attracting men with pencils and measuring sticks, men seeking fruits to export. Cattle ranchers who cut and burn the forest for pasture. They are the places where the punitive aviamento system of the rubber business drives the economy. I take comfort in the thought that none of them can really harm that massive heart of the world. The rainforest is so large and rich, it defeats all who try to conquer it." Dieter felt he was drawing closer to Charlie. "I would very much like to see these forests, but let me say that I heard the same complacent remarks about the Maine and New Hampshire woods, about the Michigan pine forest, too large to be irrecoverably harmed, and I saw them fall. There is no such thing as being too large to fall. They all go down when men come." "I hope you are wrong. Dear father, can you understand that I must go back to Brazil? What little I learned of the flowering and fruiting habits of the trees filled me with curiosity. Some seem to follow the rules of invisible seasons, but others flower from the time they sprout until they die. I want to learn why things happen as they do in that place." He looked at Dieter and said, "Tropical forest soil is rather poor. All the forest's richness is encased in its living trees. Is that not interesting?" Dieter shook his head and asked, "Is such a thing possible?" "It is, and in the level above the soil are shrubs and ferns, young trees, all dependent on shafts of light reaching them. They are not plants in their own right, but the slaves of the large trees. Even stranger are the epiphytes, an entire world of parasitic plants that grow on the trees. That forest calls to me." Dieter listened with consternation. Charlie's preference for wild forests was disturbing. It was a proof that his older son was a sinking man, fated to be a loser. How to jolt him loose? How to involve him in the company's work? "I'll do what I personally can to help you," said Dieter. "But you seem destined to observe, perhaps write a book. I do not see you holding a regular job or making a business success." "There is no job that I have heard of that would be as honorable and interesting as going about and observing the lives of the trees and noting their peculiarities. Still, men must work. Even you. The words came out so mournfully they both laughed. I need a real cause, Father, if I am to work at anything. I am no businessman, and I may indeed write a book. Although I know pitifully little, and one lifetime is not enough to study even a single tropical forest tree, I want, how can I describe it? I want to discover the dynamo, the central force of the wild forest. All my interest lies in searching out that vital force. But Dieter thought dynamo and force sounded too much like a romantic meaning-of-life quest. He had a painful thought. Did he not scent the bitter fragrance of madness in Charlie? Why not think about all this over the winter? Stay here to get your bearings, do some reading, and meet others interested in trees. We can talk again in a few months. And of course, we want you here for the holidays. He was determined to understand and help his first son, but it seemed a heavy task. Dieter felt himself too old, lost in the forest of his own experience. So Charlie stayed the winter and spring to play a game of seduction with Mrs. James Bardewolf, Caroline, alternately beckoning and evasive. He was determined to get her, to spite his half-brother, whom his father favored. He was still trying in August when the great 1910 fires in Montana, Idaho, and eastern Washington burned more than 3 million acres of prime timber and settlements in 2 days, a raging blow-up crown fire jumping and leapfrogging over hundreds of miles, a fire such as no human had ever seen. The country was shocked by headlines describing how the remote heart of America had been destroyed in 48 hours, for people believed that the wild essence of the country existed in its great forests somewhere out west. And now they had burned. Dieter pled with pea-brained politicians and barely literate congressmen for more money and authority for the Forest Service. He spoke out against that governor who said forest fires were a good thing because they opened new country for settlers, and he cursed the congressman from a fire-plagued state who bellowed, "Not 1 cent for scenery!" He began a regimen of letter-writing, wire-sending, and telephone calls. He volunteered to start new pine and fir seedling nurseries to replant the hideous blackened mountains and stem the landslides of burned soils. He tried to interest his older son. "Charlie, here's a cause for you. Help rejuvenate the spoiled lands. I am meeting this evening at the house with James Bardewolf and Andrew to discuss possible salvage of some of the burned timber. I hope you will join us." He did not think Charlie could resist the battle to heal the wrecked forest. "It will just happen again," said Charlie in a dismissive tone, "until the Yahoos have burned the country clear. You are pleading with men who just don't care. As for salvage, it seems a bit like rifling the pockets of a corpse." He left the door ajar as he went out. Charlie had had enough of Dieter's hopeless American forest projects and almost enough of the slippery Caroline. She enjoyed teasing him, and that, he promised himself, would be the key to getting her. He would make one more effort and then leave. He telephoned. "I'm leaving tomorrow morning," he said.
"Oh, Charlie, where are you going? To the terrible fires in Idaho and Montana?"
"No, the fires are ended. My interests pull me to the tropics. Let me see you one last time. Will you not walk in the garden with me for half an hour this evening?"
"I might, if you are very, very good. None of your naughty ways."
She laughed, an often rehearsed laugh that an earlier swain had told her was like the music of a babbling brook. "But you are so beautiful that I cannot make a promise. You have a powerful effect on me. As a last favor, please wear your exquisite green dress."
"Oh, my Poiret, you have an eye for fashion. That is the most expensive dress I own."
"The most beautiful," he murmured gallantly. He knew well that it was a dress famously designed to be worn without a corset. He came to the dark garden deliberately a little late, just as the moon was rising, and saw her standing beside the redbud tree, the faded, heart-shaped leaves catching the lunar glow as did her pale dress. She resembled the chrysalis of a lunar moth. The watery moonlight seemed to solidify their bodies, to render shadows corporeal, as intense as stones.
"Here you are,"
she said, and produced her rippling laugh. He seized her at once and lightly bit her neck.
"Oh, don't! It will show!"
He bit again, harder.
"Stop, Charlie! What has got into you?"
She tried to push him away, but he was not having it, and he was not playing her flirting game tonight. He pulled her to the garden bench. It took a few moments of sweet flattery and blandishment to ease her into position and gradually ruck high the green dress. He did this almost stealthily, not roughly, eased into her hot and responsive flesh, and at the moment of discharge, heard James Barterwolf's voice say, "Why, Charlie, how thoughtful of you to drop in." And there was a tremendous concussive sound that his damaged brain told him was a moonbolt, very like being struck full force with a Zulu knob carry. Caroline's shrieks brought servants from the house, who pulled the club away from James Barterwolf, who then tore a rose bush out of the ground and began flailing the insensible form on the ground. Young Raphael, in his pajamas, ran for Dieter, who arrived still clutching his meeting notes.
"James Barterwolf! Anhalten! Anhalten sofort! Stop! Halt this stupidity! Was ist los? Anhalten! You will kill him! I want to kill him! Let me go!"
The servants carried Charlie to his room, and two doctors came within the hour. Dr. Plate examined the unconscious Charlie and said it was a grave injury. He might remain unconscious for some time, forever even, might die without waking up. But he cleaned the wound, bandaged it, and left the first of three nurses to watch over the wounded man. Dr. Scott Bull examined the sobbing Caroline, who had been roughly used and violated, but was otherwise unhurt. The moon-green dress was torn and dirty. A few days in bed to rest and become calm. You must put the experience out of your mind and divert yourself with books or needlework, said the doctor, shooting sidelong glances at James Barterwolf, whose red eyes glared. The doctor steered him downstairs and poured him a glass of whiskey, watched him swallow it in a single glugging bolt. Within the half hour, James Barterwolf went up to Caroline, hissing that if she liked rape so much, that is what she would get, slapped her hard, and mounted her. The next day, James Barterwolf was discovered in Dieter's house going up the stairs with the retrieved knob carry, and once again the servants disarmed him. Dieter had Charlie moved to the hospital with a guard at the door. One son had tried to kill the other, and it was clear he was going to keep trying until he was successful. James Barterwolf, now sexually excited, kept Caroline in bed for a week. Dieter went to his younger son.
"James Barterwolf, I know he wronged your wife, insulted your honor. If he recovers, he will leave the family and live abroad. But I beg you to swallow your rage. You are young, and anger and desire to kill can sour you from the heart outward all the days of your life. I have lost one son. I cannot bear to lose you as well. I care for you deeply, James Barterwolf, and you must not blame Caroline. You must forgive."
He embraced the rigid man, tears splashing on the younger son's shoulder. But James Barterwolf was anxious to get back to Caroline and go where his older half-brother had been, and he pulled away from his father. Remembrance began to seep in, fleet, distorted images of falling, the smell of earth, moonlight. The day came when Charlie could get up and walk to the window. In early dusk he looked out. Soon, he thought. Soon, rather than late. The nights were chill. Leafless trees disclosed their angular frames. When the bandage came off, by manipulating two mirrors, he could see thick bristles of hair growing on each side of a furious dark scar.
"Father," he said to Dieter, whom he knew again, "what happened to me?"
"Something heavy fell on you in James Baderwolf's garden."
A glass with a residue of sleeping powder stood on the night table.
"In James Baderwolf's garden? Why?"
He turned the glass in his fingers.
"I see no point in keeping the information from you.
You did something schlecht. You tried to...
You ravished Caroline in the garden, and James Baderwolf discovered you in the act. Your own brother's wife. He struck you."
"This is extremely painful to hear. I do not remember this. I think you must be mistaken."
Dieter looked at him. Was he willfully lying, or did he truly not remember? He was lying. Worse, Dieter believed Charlie's mind was unsound, and he must go. Through intermediaries, Dieter arranged the purchase of a small house for him in Lugar de Barro do Rio Negro, or Manaus, the city of the forest, where the wild tropical trees would be waiting for him. The house and a modest monthly sum of money were all he could do for this child he had long ago foretold, under the silver maple in Lavinia's park, would be a man of the trees. In Amazonia, Charlie discovered himself as nothing. What he did was nothing. He saw the rampant growth of vine, shoot, sprout, seedling, moist and dripping, swollen and bursting with vigor. He vividly and without regret remembered raping Caroline. The forest sounded with the constant patter and thump as leaves, twigs, petals and fruits, branches and weak-old trees succumbed to gravity. When the storm wind called Phreagium, generated by the Antarctic, came, the noise increased, a bombardment of tree parts and fruits mixed with the hissing of the wind in the canopy. Decomposition seemed as violent, the collapse of leaf structures, cells breaking down, liquefaction of solid wood into a mold squirming with lively bacteria and animalcula seething and transforming into energy. Yes, and insects and larvae, worms and rodents, and everywhere the famous ants who ruled the tropics. He almost understood how the incomprehensible richness of Amazonia made humans clutch and rend in menadic frenzies of destruction. Such a forest was an affront, standing there smirking, aloof from its destiny of improving men's lives. Charlie was slow in learning Portuguese. His first sentence was, "Você fala inglês?" Do you speak English? But the answer was so often, "I don't understand," "não compreendo," that he struggled to master some useful words. In his first week in Manaus, making long walks around and through the town, he discovered a Portuguese paper goods shop, a livraria, that sold imported notebooks with fine French paper. He bought several. Where to begin? Perhaps it was best to make a catalog of tree species. 2 weeks of this, and he realized it was beyond him. There were simply too many kinds of trees. He did not know them, could only observe their habits. He followed rubber tappers' paths, poor men in lifelong debt servitude, no better than slaves. He pitied them, but it was not until he followed a smell into a small clearing and found a charred corpse that he could believe the ghastly rumor of punishment of those who tried to break free from the system. They were caught, wrapped around with ropes of flammable latex, and set on fire. The forest encouraged cruelties and subjugation. The furniture maker, Senor Davi Fagundes, was the only person he knew who could identify the bark, flowers, and branches he gathered. This hollow-eyed man, when Charlie had asked his usual, "Do you speak English?" question, had replied, "Yes, a little." Charlie wrote everything down in his notebooks. There were many species of mahogany, Brazilian rosewood, teak, bloodwood, exotic zebra wood, ipe and cambara woods, anigre and bubinga, kumaru and jatoba, lacewood and macore, and hundreds more without names. He felt fortunate if he could attach a name to one tree each week, draw its general shape, list some of its epiphytes and strangler vines.
Why you want knowing this? Fagundes asked. To learn the trees that grow in this kind of forest. Where I come from, there are no such forests. But more and more, the cabinet maker held up his hands and said, Eu não sei. I don't know. At the end of his first year, Charlie had sent the notebook to Dieter, as he would every year until he learned of Conrad. He heard nothing back and wondered if Dieter had abandoned him. In fact, Dieter had abandoned everyone. 65. Legacies. Not long after Charlie's departure from Chicago, Dieter, the old pine, had gone down. Mrs. Garfield, he said wearily on a Monday noon, I'm going home early. I have a headache and I think I need a night's sleep. Mrs. Garfield, who had replaced Miss Heinrich when she retired, clucked and said, I hope you feel better tomorrow. But the next morning the headache was bad, and he had a stiff neck. By the end of the week he was half paralyzed, and the doctor diagnosed polio.
I thought only children got polio, said Sophia.
No, no, it can attack at any age. But keep children away from the house. It's contagious.
Hard to breathe,
Dieter whispered. It got harder. By Saturday, pneumonia finished him. I don't care what it takes, we've got to find him, said James Bardewolf, striding to the grimy window and back. He's a major heir in the will. The situation is crazy enough. That we don't know where the hell he is makes it worse. I'm going to get a private detective on it. Andrew Harkis made a sound that was almost a laugh.
You've been reading too many books, James Bardewolf. I'm sure Dieter had his address.
Have you asked Mrs. Garfield? And isn't it likely that he gave the address to Mr. Gray when he made his will? He picked up the telephone and dialed. Mrs. Garfield, do we have Charlie Breitsprecher's address?
Yes, sir. It's in the correspondence file. I'll get it.
Well, good, said James Bardewolf. We'll ask Mr. Gray to send someone from his office with the necessary papers, and I will enclose my personal letter. He had been composing the letter in his mind for several years, and now he would write it. The young lawyer, excited by the journey to the tropics, though after seeing dead monkeys in the market he wanted to be back in Chicago, had no trouble finding Charlie Breitsprecher, disheveled and rather yellow, in the muddy river town. He told him Dieter had passed and handed him the envelope of documents. Charlie sent the young man back to his hotel and arranged to meet him for dinner. When he was alone, he read the lawyer's letter, read James Bardewolf's handwritten page, shook his head, wept, and read it again. James Bardewolf had written, Dear Charlie, we both have very much to regret and resolve. I am deeply, deeply sorry for attacking you. I have suffered pangs of conscience ever since that night, and Caroline, who blames herself for all. But as they say, there is no wind so ill that it does not bring some good. The good is our son, Conrad. We love him. Our father, Dieter, taught me that holding on to anger is a great evil. If you return some day to your family in Chicago, you will be received with affection. Your brother, James Bardewolf Breitsprecher.
None more sorry than I am, James Bardewolf, said Charlie to the letter.
Hours later, he read the details of the will and, after half a quart of brandy, tore a page from his notebook and took up his pen. Dear sir, he wrote to Mr. Gray, he disclaimed most of his portion of Dieter's estate, saying, I would like it to go to my brother, James Bardewolf Breitsprecher, and his wife, Caroline Breitsprecher, for reasons they know. A month later, when Dieter's will and Charlie's letter were read, James Bardewolf caught his breath. How Charlie had changed down there in the jungle. But then, he too had altered. In Brazil, for the next 7 or 8 years, Charlie sent his notebooks not to Dieter, but to the boy, Conrad Breitsprecher, often with a letter and a sketch of some comic tropical insect.
his malaria attacks increased in ferocity. His 40th birthday had brought him his mother's legacy, but he chose to stay in his little house. The work, which he would not leave even for an hour, was everything. Tenacity was in his bone marrow. Yet he dared make only short forays into the forest, for if he went deeper and the malaria laid him low, he might be unable to struggle back to his house. Twice the attacks had led to seizures that left him half dead on the floor. He came into Signor Fagundes's shop clutching a black twig with 7 leaves. He was shaking and too ill to speak. He held out the branch to the man who had become something like a friend. The cabinet maker took the shaking branch, twisted a leaf, looked in his dictionary.
Leopardwood. Not same like lacewood, but look almost a little.
Charlie swayed, put his hand out to take his twig, and dropped to the floor, convulsed. Signor Fagundes, shocked and afraid, hoping the man did not have a pestilent disease, called the hospital for an ambulance. Charlie Duke Breitsprecher, ever a man of contradictions, died a week later of Plasmodium falciparum in Manaus, after writing in his last notebook,
"Nothing in the natural world, no forest, no river, no insect nor leaf, has any intrinsic value to men. All is worthless, utterly dispensable, unless we discover some benefit to ourselves in it." Even the most ardent forest lover thinks this way. Men behave as overlords. They decide what will flourish and what will die. I believe that humankind is evolving into a terrible new species, and I am sorry that I am one of them.
The final sentence was his will, a scrawled request that this last notebook be sent to Conrad, and all that he possessed, his fortune inherited from Lavinia and Dieter's seedling nursery, be held in trust for the boy until he turned 21. The early months of the war in Europe did not much affect remote Chicago. As conflict sucked in country after country, Americans went about their lives and voted to stay neutral. James Bardewolf and Caroline thought not of war, but of the future, and considered schools for Raphael, Claude, and Conrad, handsome boys marked for success.
"This military academy in Indiana," said James Bardewolf, holding up a paper, "has a high reputation for educating young men of good character, closer than Eastern schools. I say we take a trip to Indiana to look it over."
James enrolled Raphael and Claude in the school and put down young Conrad's name, he was barely 9, to hold a place for him. And, as the yellow mists of chlorine gas spread over Ypres, James Bardewolf and Caroline returned to Chicago with their brochures and impressions.
"We got them where we want them,"
said Andrew Harkus, recovered from the Spanish flu that had killed Chicagoans like chickens. Great rollers of change beat on national shores. Newly independent but poor countries, once the colonial holdings of the great European powers, struggled to join the global scuffle. What these countries have is the raw materials, forests and minerals and oil. We'd be fools not to get in on this. South America, Asia, all kinds of hardwood. It's our chance. James Bardewolf, curious one day about the notebooks Charlie had sent to Conrad, looked into them and found them filled with useful information on the qualities of tropical trees. He showed them to Andrew.
"Papa, I want my notebooks back," said young Conrad, who, instead of reading Tom Swift stories, found the grimy pages, punctuated with squashed gnat and mosquito corpses, interesting for their opaque originality, and because this uncle he had never met had bequeathed him the notebooks and the seedling nursery business. The company, now Breitsprecher Duke, in league with banks, other timber outfits, the mining industry, coffee, cocoa, banana, and mango importers, became part of the new colonialism. When the great onslaught on tropical forests began, they were in the van, taking all they could. Charlie Breitsprecher's notebooks were used to plunder his forest.
At 16, after a summer on a cattle ranch where the work was considered character-building and healthful, Conrad fell ill with headaches and chills, painful joints, and a deep weariness. He was diagnosed with undulant fever and kept in bed most of the fall and winter. He began to recover, and in the spring, the doctor recommended 3 months' rest at a hotel sanatorium in the mountains of New Hampshire. There he experienced a day never forgotten that bound him forever to forests. He fell in love with a local girl, Sally Shaw, a waitress in the dining room. Most of the visitors took breakfast in their rooms, but every morning he sat near his favorite east window and she brought him tea and the institution's famous popovers. She spoke to him in a teasing voice about the weather or the breakfast offerings, but he felt strangely happy when she came to his table with the teapot. Her hands were small but deft, her nails lacquered, her black straight hair cut fashionably short. Very red lipstick outlined the rosebud shape of her mouth. She flirted. The room was quiet except for the swish of the door to the kitchen and the soft chink of silverware. The gray mountain slopes showed a frost of pale green, the buds of emerging leaves. When the sun struck, they glowed a luminous gold green. Conrad blurted out his wish that she would go walking with him on the mountain. "I think you must know the best place to walk," he said. "Say, do I ever? Tomorrow? I got the afternoon off." She had heard he was a rich man's son. It was not a fair day. Heavy mist hung over the mountains, yet the afternoon went in a direction he had not dared hope for. They walked up a steep trail. There was a clumsy kiss as they veered into sweet fern, her shrill laugh, then grappling and rolling on the ground. The perfume of crushed sweet fern fixed the experience. A light rain began. When he looked beyond her, he saw an army of perfect young white pine trees glistening in the wet mist, bursting with the urgency of growth. The rain, falling slant and silver, amplified their resinous fragrance. It was raining. The girl, her hair in ratty wet tails, was pulling at him to go back to the hotel, but he was happy. And somehow he was caught, not by the girl, but by the little pines. After the crash of 29, the country staggered under the weight of economic depression and the rage of striking workers. Breitsprecher Duke began to lose its footing. James Bardewolf told Conrad, now finished with school and with a degree that fitted him for nothing, that the family company would employ him if he wished, but without salary. After all, he had money he could live on, and Breitsprecher Duke was enduring hard times. Raphael was counting on his smooth good looks for a job in films, and Claude worked for a real estate company specializing in Western ranch properties. Since Roosevelt, cattle ranching had been popular with those who still had wealth. "Let me think about it, Father," Conrad said. He thought instead of Dieter's old seedling nursery business. Could anything be done with it? It had been more of a hobby for Dieter, with very few clients, but over the years he had kept on a single employee, Alfred Mackerlane, who managed the greenhouses. Perhaps it was time to evaluate the nursery, to talk with Mackerlane. Conrad had been very young the first time he was in one of the greenhouses, a visit with his parents and brothers. He remembered a long, long wet concrete floor with hoses and watering cans in the aisle. There was a man in a yellow raincoat. Raphael and Claude had run down the aisle and were leaning over a tank at the end. Conrad followed them. When he looked into the dark water, he saw huge, slow-moving creatures, orange, spotted black and white like cows. James Bardewolf said they were koi, a kind of fish.
"Why are they so slow?" asked Raphael.
"Because they have seen everything in the tank. Nothing new," James Bardewolf answered, and he laughed. But Caroline was upset and demanded that the koi be caught and brought to the pond in the garden.
"At least they will have a better life," she said.
2 days later, though, Conrad saw a pair of great blue herons at the edge of the pond,
and when he went closer to see if the fish were visibly enjoying their new freedom, the birds flew up, leaving behind the bones of the orange koi. Very little had changed in the greenhouse. Al McElane was not wearing a yellow raincoat, but hoses still stretched and coiled on the wet floor. As a child, Conrad had not noticed the seedlings, but now he saw them, spruce and pine. He looked first at the account books and client lists, for the nursery did a small but steady business. Al, it looks like our customers are mostly local parks and private landscape concerns. And just spruce and pine seedlings? I see very few lumber company clients. Tell me how you think our position stands and if you think it might be improved. McElane was surprised at Conrad's serious interest. He had expected Conrad to say the business would be sold or closed down. Well, you know, we go along. Timbermen that want to replant just leave a few seed trees and let the trees do the job. Nobody's got any money these hard times, even if they believed in planting seedlings, which they don't. But a guy from Weyerhaeuser come around a month or two ago asking questions about how we set up, where we get the seeds and all. I think they might be planning to get their own nursery going. They have the money to do it. They are the only timber people making a profit.
And my grandfather Dieter was doing this 50 years ago. I wonder if there's not a real future for our seedling nursery.
That would be my thought, said McElane. They talked and walked through the other glass houses. There were 5, all old and in poor shape. It didn't take Conrad long to discover that McElane was as ignorant of new research and knowledge on seedling propagation, cloning, forest genetics, and site preparation as Conrad himself. He was putting his hands on a finicky, complicated business that called for extensive knowledge on the part of both the seedling grower and the planter. I have to back up, he said to McElane. I don't know what I need to know. I have to go to forestry school. I think we can keep the greenhouses running as they are for the clients that still depend on us until I learn enough to map out a new plan. One thing is sure, seedlings are the best way to keep forests alive. That night he made a list of questions. What would be the needs of future seedling buyers? McElane had been raising and selling will grow anywhere pine and spruce bare root seedlings, but there was evidence that most of these died when planted on rough, logged-over sites. Site preparation would help, but what companies could afford the labor and machinery in these times? He strained to put his mind into the future, when the need for timber would press harder. Which species would timbermen demand? What were the diseases? What were the best planting sites? And how should the sites be prepared? Nature's most dramatic way of replenishing the forest was fire. Loggers could duplicate such sites by clear-cutting and burning the slash. But which species did well in burned-over land? Which would suffer from possible invasion by wild grasses and plants? He enrolled in forestry school, and as he studied, he saw more and more difficulties. The real knot was the timber industry. He would have to persuade logging companies and lumbermen that their future was linked to his. If they wanted trees to cut in the future, they would have to plant new seedlings among the stumps. They would have to learn to think in decades and hundreds of years. They could not depend on leaving a few wild trees to seed the barren cuts. Experience showed there was poor regeneration. Again and again, as he asked questions of college experiment stations and men who had tried reseeding, he came back to the same difficulty. Site preparation was vital. Timbermen had to see that doing the work and paying the costs was to their benefit. Conrad made a decision. Breitsprecher would offer site preparation as a service. In the forestry school, he heard of someone who had made craft paper cylinders, filled them with soil, and planted a seed in each. These seedlings did better than those with bare roots when set out on the same site. But was it practical to grow seedlings this way? Practical matters demanded experimentation. He had to include research in his plans. And there were costs. A square foot of nursery space could produce how many seedlings of what species with what labor and time and maintenance? Were there optimum or minimum sizes for seedlings? Were there limits? Yes, there were always limits. He had to find them. Finally, could the seedlings be priced to allow some profit, or should he just hope to break even? For already he was inclining toward philanthropy, using his Uncle Charlie's legacy. By 1939, he knew enough to work out a long-range plan. He built new greenhouses and set up a seedling experiment with 11 tree species. Al Mackerlane was busy with two new workers, Pedro Vaca, a young Mexican who told fanciful but amusing tales, and Hank Stone, the son of German immigrant grandparents who had changed their name from Stein during the Great War. A separate building was a small laboratory office, though he had not yet found the research horticulturist or plant breeder that he wanted. He had liked Elsie Guderian, one of the few women enrolled in the forestry school and interested in plant heredities, but she had another year before graduation. "Once I've got that degree," she said, indicating she wanted the job. She was stocky, with hard red cheeks and horse legs, but a true researcher. What he wanted. War was in the pure air once again, in the inky newspapers. It seemed to older people a continuation of the war they had grown up with, coming to a boil after just enough time to raise a new crop of sacrificial young men. A pattern was emerging. Every 25 years or so, another war would keep the human world stumbling along, a human boom and bust carried to deadly extremes. The Breitsprechers and Dukes had escaped military service for generations, but Conrad was called up. Both Raphael and Claude knew the right people. Conrad knew only Al Mackerlane and some forestry professors. Growing nursery seedlings was not a vital agricultural occupation. He came back from the South Pacific in 1945, face and body damaged and changed, thoughts changed, ideas and beliefs changed. And when once more he shook Al Mackerlane's hand and walked through the seedling greenhouses, he thought that the rows of spiky, fresh, green, sturdy little pines were the most beautiful things he had ever seen. Sixty-six. Her Place in the Sun. Plywood and fiberboard kept Breitsprecher Duke alive. During the Second World War, they experimented with interior and exterior hardboard siding, but after 2 years of moisture problems with different recipes, one unhappy trial involved seaweed and corn husk pulp, they dropped the product and concentrated on their plywood, bright ply, made of culls and forest fire salvage. In the years after the war, they caught the tail end of the building boom, but bigger companies supplied by cheaper Canadian wood sent them into decline, although the illusion of a productive, busy wood products company headed by two dynamic men, James Bardewolf Breitsprecher and Andrew Harkis, persisted. Both men photographed well, standing in front of a mountain of logs, or the glittering rotary peeler, but like plywood, these images were only a surface layer covering inferior material. The younger generation of Breitsprechers wanted nothing to do with the plywood company. But Sophia Hannah Breitsprecher Harkis, the youngest of Dieter's children, had her own idea of a place in the works. She found her brother and her husband annoyingly obtuse. "Andrew, I do not understand why you and James Bardewolf don't let me into the company. For God's sake, it's the 60s, not the Dark Ages. I have no position." She had grown up listening to Dieter's stories of how Lavinia Duke, his first wife, apparently a reincarnation of Elizabeth I, had controlled the lumber business since her youth, and it seemed to Sophia, only vaguely aware of the company's decline, that she too should have a title. Her children were grown. Why should she not have a career? "You are a company director. You sit on the board," said Andrew. "Very few companies have women on their boards. You have influence in that way, and your comments are taken into consideration. What more do you want?" "I want a position. I want an office and the responsibility of that office." She kept banging out this tune for more than a year until Harkis said he would discuss it with James Bardewolf, who, as president of the company and paterfamilias, had the say. But she could not come up with a specific description of what her position might be.
She wants to make a career move, Harkus said gloomily to his brother-in-law. You'd think she'd calm down now that she's a grandmother. Instead, she is like a rolling cannonball on the deck of a ship. She wants an office and her name on the door, a telephone, and probably an expense account, which she'll spend on clothes. He and James Bardewolf were having dinner at the Wild Goose in Sherman Oaks, James Bardewolf slashing at his veal cutlet Oscar, Andrew Harkus picking gingerly at boned pheasant with a Kahlua sauce. How's the pheasant? Asked James Bardewolf. Harkus made a face. Unusual. I think I prefer gravy to Kahlua. They were silent for a few minutes while the waiter hovered, filled their glasses with the sharp white wine. Harkus drank greedily to rid his mouth of the Kahlua. But what would Sophia do? James Bardewolf wanted to resolve the issue. I don't know. For God's sake, she doesn't know. It's the change of life or something, and you know how they get. They made up the vaporish, flighty, talkative, scrambling world of women. Yet her husband understood that she had been biding her time for years, and that she would not let this drop. I told her the company isn't the monolith she seems to think it is. I told her we had discussed selling out. She blew her top. How could we think of such a thing? Ineffective management, lax ways, blah, blah. I suppose I can put it to her that she has to draw up a formal request outlining the duties she would assume. Tell her that vague wishes bear no fruit. I hope we can find something to quiet her down. James Bardewolf glanced at the dessert wagon against the wall. The waiter saw the glance and hurried to snatch up two dessert menus. How about something to do with the arts? She's always been interested in museums and concerts. She can do something cultural or civic. Community relations? Sophia feels entitled to a place in the company. She's smart, I admit that. Too smart, maybe. Andrew Harkus thought of his wife's years of correction of his appearance, how she sniped at his way of speaking, realigned the way he marshaled his facts. He sometimes felt he was married not to Sophia, but to James Bardewolf. They spoke the same language. She's not young, but I can tell you that pointing that fact out to her will produce Vesuvius in action. Let's wait and see if she can come up with an idea on her own. Harkus saw that Kahlua sauce figured in two of the sweets on the dessert menu. He asked for butterscotch pie, but even that came with an arabesque of the moody liqueur drizzled down the triangle. He sent it back, saying, "The chef must have stock in the company." Andrew Harkus told Sophia that James Bardewolf had asked that she write out a description of the job she wanted. "Yes, yes," she said, and went upstairs to her closet to sort out old, boring clothes that she would replace on a shopping trip to New York, for Chicago did not really have good garment shops. The specific position she wanted, whatever it was, would come to her. The flight to New York bumped over a cloudscape that looked like trays packed with cauliflower heads. The air evened out later in the afternoon. As they flew toward darkness, approaching the cities of the east, the slender tangles of light below became great webs, the radiant country glittering in the night. Sophia stayed at the Waldorf, as the Breitsprechers always did. From her room, she telephoned her cousin Althea Evans, who had married a Wall Street stockbroker. She and Althea could shop together and have an elegant lunch. A maid answered the phone. "Mrs. Evans is away. They are in Boca." "Where?" "Boca. Boca Raton, in Florida."